Hello and welcome to Ask Matt. I'm Eugene Cordero, professor of meteorology and climate science at San Jose State and founder and director of Green Ninja, a middle school publisher that uses climate and environmental solutions as a lens for teaching science and engineering. I'm here with Matt Delasio, geology professor from Cal State Northridge, NGSS expert, and one of the chief authors of the 2016 California Science Framework. As is normal, I ask Matt questions about science, science education, and NGSS, and we all learn something more about education and how to make the transition to NGSS easier and more effective for everyone. During this episode, we'll be joined by a special guest, Tashonda Giles-Jones. Tashonda is a teacher at the Environmental Charter Middle School in Inglewood, California. Today, Tashonda is going to share with us her work in helping students become leaders in their community through outdoor and environmental projects. And this will help us all discuss the place that outdoor education could have in an NGSS classroom. As usual, if you have any of your own questions, just send them to info@greenninja.org, and we'll include those questions in a future episode. So let's get started. Tashonda, thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to learning more about your work.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to share the work we do over at ETS.
Great. Can you tell us about your school and why it's different from many other schools we might be able to visit?
Absolutely. So we are very different, but increasingly becoming very common across the United States as far as goals around environmental education is. We are a network of three schools, soon to be four. We have our high school that is located in Lawndale, California. That is our longest standing. We just celebrated 20 years. We will be opening a second high school in Gardena to help funnel our middle school students to further their education through our program. And we have two middle schools, one in Gardena, and I work at our youngest middle school, Inglewood, where we're approaching 10 years of being established. And this will be my eighth school year with the organization. I would say one thing that makes us very specific, I mean, we are a charter school. We're a public charter school, so anybody can apply to attend our school, and applications are picked through a lottery system, like most charter schools. We are focused heavily around the environment, but we are a college readiness, which just really means getting students prepared to go out into the world, regardless of vocational studies or college studies. We use the environment as a vehicle to teach across all content levels. We're a very interdisciplinary school, so that means that all of our classes are planning together across grade levels and disciplines, which really allows us to infuse environmental literacy amongst all disciplines, which I think is what really helps us deliver a student-centered curriculum at all levels.
That sounds so awesome. So tell us sort of like what you feel like the best results are. You're talking about both the academic side of things and also the social side of things. What do you think you're accomplishing?
Oh my gosh. I think some of the most important things that I find at our campuses, at our organization from the top down, is that we choose to explicitly focus on a particular student-centered issue or something that we are being responsive to instead of reactive to. So let's just say, for instance, as an entire organization, we had taken on a learning strategy of reader's apprenticeship. So regardless of what content level you are in, if you're in math, if you're in college readiness, if you are in art, you're using the strategies of getting kids to metacognitively understand the way that they're learning and they're thinking. And so it's been really interesting to see all teachers, all paras, all staff use this same strategy with their given content, discipline, facility role, and see it be very consistent through the kids and the way that they're thinking about the way they're learning. So we're really looking at how they're progressing and using the outdoors as one vehicle, right, to get these kids to use those skills of thinking the way they're learning so that we're creating these lifelong learners who are very like knowledgeable, but also are understanding what it takes to continue to learn and are learning those interpersonal skills to be able to do that in the classroom, outside of the classroom, which has been really interesting work because we're doing it from the top down and from the bottom up.
Now, people sign up to go to your charter school, but Do you get pushback from parents that think, oh, this isn't really, you know, this isn't how I learned? You know, I learned math and with a textbook like this in my class, and I did science. How do you respond to that, or what approach do you use when you have those kind of conversations?
Yeah, that's a conversation we have with each other too, right? I like to call it like unteaching the teacher. It's like the traditional way of learning. Like I remember learning in a very standard, strategic type of way that was, you know, across the board and not very individualized except for where I sought it out, right? And so having a program that's like this, that's very different than where you might go to another school that's very specifically or heavily guided by a outcome. Although we are also guided by an outcome, the outcomes look very differently. So what we do to combat that kind of pushback from families, if and when we do get it, is to be very transparent and to share exactly what we're trying to do. And mind you, what we do with students are the same things we do with staff and the same things we do with parents. You know, if we are teaching our students how to cook and nutrition, we will do a PD about it. We will share information across the board with staff and teachers. We will also create cooking classes for parents that mirror the same time the students are, so that learning is across the board and we're bringing everybody kind of to the table, but also meeting them where they're at academically with social emotional learning and creating kind of that culture and that space that allows us to use the outdoors where you're not so fearful. You know, we create these safe spaces, and now we're pushing that into like creating grace spaces so that the academics is just intertwined with it all.
So that's pretty cool. I love these big picture things. Now, can you give us a specific example of some sort of this one of these lessons that you feel like you walk us through one of the lesson sequences that you feel is a really powerful example of how this works?
Yeah. So I teach my classes Green Ambassadors. So my course is heavily dependent on the structure of our school, right? And I get my students 6th through 8th grade. So I'm scope and sequencing what they learn. And I am science-based. However, I'm using environmental literacy as kind of my guiding tool. I am teaching life science in addition to some earth science, but they also have a science class where they're getting their physics and their chemistry and all that great stuff. So when I am planning and doing my unit plans, I'm teaching, again, 6th through 8th grade. So they're topic specific, but they're also building on top of each other. So by the time they leave me in 8th grade, if I want them to be versed in natural resources, not just recycling, right? If I want them to be versed on soil science and not just composting, and then by 8th grade that they're able to go out into the world and speak about what they know and make decisions that are based on knowledge and not just that they learned how to plant seeds. It starts in 6th grade. And so lessons are focused on natural resources and the material system. Students learning about renewable and non-renewable. Those lessons are always paired with garden science. So we're always connecting the ecology to the science part of earth science. And then by the time they get to 7th grade, they're learning ecosystems and biodiversity, where we're looking at bigger biomes and then paring it down to like local ecosystems, particularly California being such a hot spot. It's a great opportunity, a great field to be able to cover a lot of biodiversity work. And then by 8th grade, they're looking more at the overall philosophy of things per se, right? The ethics around how we use our natural resources, why it's important to pay attention to ecosystems because we are part of systems. And so they're learning about tragedy of the commons. They're learning about anthropogenic epoch. We're looking at global changes and models and how humans and growth of populations impact that. And like coming up in 4th, they'll be looking at using Journey 2050, which is a great interactive curriculum, where they'll be looking at urban agriculture and how all of the things they've learned since 6th and 7th grade then go into like the decisions they'll make in the future. How do we grow food? How do we use energy to grow food? How do we use water to grow food? What policies, like the Farm Bill, goes behind what governs how we grow food and how we sell food? And so they get all of that knowledge in addition to the practice. If we're on campus, everything is tied into the work we do on campus and what our campus looks like. They're learning the knowledge, they learn the skills, and then they get the time to practice those skills because they have to take care of our campus, which equates to a larger, we got to take care of our earth, right? And so those are kind of the steps that we take to kind of change behavior, but build some skill sets.
Gosh, you know, that's just sounding so amazing. And I'm really interested in your middle school. When students leave, and you kind of described this just now about the skills and practices that you hope they have, could you compare between a student who graduates from your school and maybe a student who graduates from more of a traditional school? Like, what are the hopes that, for going back to the parent who's going to decide where their child might go, if they were to say, what are those 3 years going to do compared to going to a more formal educational setting?
Well, I would say access and exposure for sure, right? Like a school like ours, our kids go camping every year for free, even up into the high school. They get a camping experience where we can tie in nature and what it looks like in the wild versus the like nature and what we live in it. Most middle schools only offer, they offer their science classes, and depending on the needs of that particular campus, they might be focusing heavier on STEM and more mathematical than they are the actual science. So most middle school kids really aren't getting a bolt of science like biology, life science, depth that is connected to earth science until they're in high school. So at our school, compared to a regular school, not only are you getting those classes every year, but it's infused in your history class, in your science class, in your English class. You might be reading papers on fracking, you know, in English. Your novels you're reading are connected to some kind of nature sense or naturalistic or conservation type of topic. If you're in math class, you might be equating like how to build raised beds and how to build boats and then taking them out. And in your PE class, you could be learning about digestive systems and learning about cells. And all of these things are super connected, where in a traditional school, unfortunately, you're still being taught in kind of silos. You are seeing more of a flow towards integrating, but having worked in a traditional school, I can still see where, you know, departments aren't planning together. You know, it's like I teach this course and this is what I'm teaching and this is the standard that they need to know and this is how I'm going to teach it. And I understand that because it takes a lot to go beyond what you can get that's already created. And it takes a lot to be able to connect all the web pieces that children really do need to see and experience. So I've noticed with our students that leave us, even if they don't go on to our high school, I have students that message me back and are just like, I'm killing it in biology because I know what they're talking about, right? Like, I understand they've started composting at home, right? They've gotten their families to be more cautious about recycling and why. And I use a lot of high school material. You know, I'm dealing with 10 and 11 year olds when they come in. But what I have found is what I teach at middle school in my courses, if I go to an 11th grade environmental science class, I'm teaching the same thing. The level of vocabulary might be a little bit more, or should be more at 11th grade level, right? Mm-hmm. But I take college material and I just make it work because earth is earth, right? Worms are worms. Soil is soil. You know, you're going to learn those things. It's just the depth in which you make the connections for kids. And so I'm trying to do that earlier. So when they get higher, they're searching for more. Their questions are more curious to the point where they're now starting to create solutions. It's not basic questions of, well, how does that work? They know that. They know how it works. And so now they can look at why it doesn't work, or how to make it work better, or how to make it work more in unison, because they have stronger connections. And I think that's the difference than you would see in a traditional school.
That sounds fantastic. If I'm a teacher now that's thinking, I want to do that at my school.
Yeah.
How would we get started with this? Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have quite that same framework that you've just described that your school is built upon. So what entry points do I have?
Yeah, that's a really difficult one because depending on what kind of school system you are in, depending on your level of interest, because usually this type of work happens in a traditional school with a teacher who's like, this is something I believe in outside of my classroom. This is something that's passionate to me personally. And so those are usually the teachers that'll take it on. If you try to take a math teacher and be like, I really want you to teach a little bit more environmental, they're going to be like, what? That's not really my thing. So I can say one way that I did it before I was even in this particular situation or organization is I really just made sure I knew what I was talking about. And what I tried to do is tackle the fears that I had about like taking kids outside. What would that look like? And not just for me, because I found that I didn't have fear from that just because of the way I came to this work, that I think my fear was not having the fear. Like, what am I missing? What should I be fearful about? You know, where most teachers would be like, well, what if a kid falls or something? I'm like, I hope that kid falls. Like, yeah, kids need like all kinds of experiences. So I was coming to the work very different, you know, of wanting kids to have all these experiences. And I know that most teachers come to it with fearful of kids like hurting themselves or being fearful of being outside themselves because that's not something they're with. So I always say, just really start with yourself and getting comfortable with whatever surroundings you want to be in. Because if you're not comfortable, your students aren't going to be comfortable. If you don't feel like you're in a space where you can really teach what you need to teach, then the kids aren't going to be in it, right? And so that's the first step. And then I also think there's a misconception that you have to create these curriculums just to be outside. And I think there are ways to look at the curriculums and the lessons you already have and find the nature in between what you already have. I think it becomes overwhelming of like, how do I create a lesson that involves the outdoors? Well, almost everything we teach and we do involves nature in one way or another, right? It's just being able to identify where it makes sense. So again, like if you have a math class and you're teaching angles, math is so far out of my realm, but if you know, if you're teaching something about dimensions or width or angles, I mean, you can use leaves and trees and plants and bugs and just like soil. There's so many things that are just there for you to use. So slowing down and like taking that fear away too can be very helpful. And then getting others to support it. Like the work I do, I could not do without the support of my facility team. Like they're the ones who know where all the power is. They're the ones who know where all the water is. They're the ones who are going to pop up tents for you. They're the ones that are going to get extra chairs and tables. Like those are the go-to folks on your campus if you're trying to create a space outside, is making sure they're always involved. Or at least asking, because they'll know, like if wind comes through one side, oh, you don't want to be there, the trash truck is going to come in and it's going to be loud during this hour, like those kind of just logistical things. And then having your admin, for sure. I've worked in schools where the admin, it was just kind of hands off because it wasn't their space. They didn't really understand. And so being able to kind of fight red tape and establish stuff on your campus, your admin has to be involved. They have to want to be involved, but they also have to want to kind of learn a little bit or trust that you're going to be able to share what you know. And then getting other teachers to like share spaces, right? Like do it together. I've done stuff with our art class where we've shared students. If like a lot of teachers are concerned about time blocks and having time to do these, we do these like those television shows where they do cross television for like Marvel or whatever. We make it like a thing and we do it a crossover. So it's like, I'm going to get your students for, you know, a week or a class, and you're going to get my students, and we're going to be teaching somewhat of the same thing just in our own content. And then we'll do like a field trip where we're all together. So it's like being creative, trying to break your mold of what you're used to. If you have the support, you can really be creative. And one thing about our org is really our mission, literally, is like to reimagine what public school looks like for our community of students. And it doesn't have to look the same to get the outcomes we want. And it's just taking away that fear.
That's a really, you shared that so nicely. Matt, when you in the California Department of Education, what guidance do they have about outdoor education and in the framework that you helped write?
Well, I mean, it really ties with what Tashonda was saying. She's trying to find things that are around you. If you're talking about angles, look at the angles around you and, find those things that are around. And I feel like that's the number one thing that the framework gives guidance on, is we're trying to find local and relevant challenges and problems and phenomena. And that's basically the number one rule, is find stuff that the kids care about. And this is one of the reasons why Janani talked about food and looking at, everything from cooking to the growing of the food to the energy that goes into it. And just, that is something that we would just, there's nothing more relevant to a kid than food, right? and so I just love that that sort of central thing. Fun fact about research, one of my favorite research studies, which is looking at, there's actually testing in some states on kindergarten science. I do not necessarily support this particular thing, but they looked at what actually helps contribute to students doing well on kindergarten science standardized tests. And it turns out that spending time on science does not correlate with students doing well on science tests and standardized science tests in kindergarten. You know what does? Cooking in the classroom.
I believe it.
And it's because, it's that experience that they have. There's so much in there that is relevant to science from cooking and the experiences. So that's my one of my favorite things to share with people. And like I said, I don't condone standardized tests for kindergartners, but in some states they do them. And this is what we find is that cooking is amazing. And so, that's the finding stuff that kids care about and that they can do and that's relevant to their lives and making those connections.
And it really is. And it provides a springboard for so many other things where I've always believed that kids should be cooking. I cooked in school. I had home ec and we learned how to make recipes. But again, the way that you can combine so many content levels in cooking. But now I'm at the point where our program has brought in partnerships. So we have partners who come in and cook and share, and I can bring in guest chefs. But we also have extended it to like citizen science and skill building and community work, where that's led to taking pre-consumed compost from local restaurants where the kids are composting it. And then they're like, well, what are we going to do with the compost? Well, let's grow food to give it back to the restaurants. It grew into like building a community garden with another partner, where now the kids, even at home, like I give them garden kits every semester, every quarter. They grow seedlings at home. We do it like separate, but together. And whoever wants to bring theirs into the community garden to continue to grow can, or they can keep it at home. It's that practice and that learning, but it's also changing their behavior and their mindsets. And it's like just them taking care of a seedling instills like their understanding that something else, another organism needs to be taken care of, what that takes. It's teaching them, that nutrition that is growing that they have to give to that plant is then going to feed them. There's so many connections that you can make when you explicitly decide to, right? And you pinpoint it. There's not one lesson I do where I'm not like, wait, I could talk about this, or I could bring back that, or this connects to this. And then sooner than later, the students start seeing it. They start making it. I had a student who just told me the other day, she's just like, because I'm very rigorous in my class as well. Like I said, I will use high school and college material. And I had a student, she's like, oh gosh, I know I'm behind, but it's so much work. And then Mr. P, who's our eighth grade science teacher, she goes, and he's got so much stuff. She goes, but when I stopped and I thought, you guys are talking about the same stuff. It's kind of the same things. Like she had made this aha moment of, if I just like slow down and pay attention, each class is helping me answer the other one. And I'm like, yeah, honey, it's designed that way. That's exactly what we want to see. So food is really important, and water, because we sit in a watershed that's very visible to the students. I can walk them to the channel where directly stuff that leaves our campus, if it leaves in a storm drain, will end up 5 blocks away in this channel. And we can see like how far down we are and how close we are to an open body of water, to the ocean. So it makes it relevant. It makes it real. It makes it tangible that them picking up trash actually is an action they can understand. I think that's the depth we want in this kind of education.
So is the channel that you go to is one of the concrete channel parts of the LA River system? So if it is, then thinking about what you said, nature is all around us, and seeing this there's part of this urban ecosystem that is really a different way of seeing what it means to be living in an ecosystem when we live in kind of an urban environment. I'm really excited about sort of opening people's eyes up to that aspect of things. So tell me about how that feels, and you know, the community around you, and what sort of what the built environment looks like.
Yes, very much so. So let me give you a picture of where we're at. We are in Inglewood, where we're less than half a mile from the new Rams and Chargers stadium. So we've been undergoing that kind of construction just north of us. We are off of a major highway, Imperial Highway, that goes as far west as the airport and as far east, like way, way east. So we get a lot of big rigs, you know, a lot of through traffic consistently. We are just north to the south of us is the 105 freeway, and we have LAX flight plan, you know, above us. So we are as urban and central as you can possibly get, right? There's not much open green space. There's an elementary school that's a few blocks away that did kind of build a park, but it's not accessible to us to use. It's only for the elementary school. So we had to create, and that was part of the learning. Like, because of our human environment, which is still part of the environment, we still have squirrels, we still have possums, we have raccoons, you know, we still have this wildlife. We get hawks ever so often. And so when I first got to the campus, this was already, you know, a goal of our organization, because our high school, all of our campuses are living campuses. We don't just have gardens. We create habitat and shelter and food on every possible plot of space on our site, indoors and outdoors if we can. And so we're utilizing a lot of urban agricultural techniques and strategies to show kids all the different ways it might look like to grow up in an urban setting, you know, in their future. But we also understand our importance of being close to a sea, being a coastal ecosystem. They're learning what that means. They understand what a biome means and how the species that are native to our area, what they need to be able to continue to survive. You know, they weigh, you know, what the development and regenerating this land would look like for these species. And so we set out to do that. And so our entire campus is built to include pollinators, migrating pollinators, building ecosystems on our site as organically as possible. That means creating water spaces for, you know, migrating bugs and introducing beneficial native bugs so that we're not using any toxins at all and no synthetic fertilizers, that we're recreating our own soil. The kids are all part of that. They're all part of capturing the rainwater to reuse it. And we have pretty much doubled, if not tripled, our species biodiversity on campus, from bird all the way down to insects. We have way more migrating butterflies. We've gotten 3 new introductions of species that are consistently showing up on our campus. We have about 5 generations of hummingbirds that come back and are now using, like, the cotton we grow on campus as part of their nest. Those are things we look at. Like, if we're introducing trees that create fiber or texture, like, are the animals and the insects that are living on our campus utilizing them in their habitat? So everything we plant is either got to provide food for a human or another organism. It has to create shelter so that we are, you know, effectively and sustainably handling our energy and our buildings. It has to create some kind of habitat for an organism or allow us to use that resource to create. And so we're teaching them that, and they're actively having to not only be responsible for it, but the goal is that they then feel accountable. And then they start taking those same kind of practices home and creating that in their own home space. And we do see that. We see that happening. We do see that happening with our families.
Tashonda, you've painted an amazing picture. And so for those teachers who are listening in right now, you gave some good advice about how to get started. But are there some organizations or lists or magazines or something else that you might recommend to someone who says, gosh, this sounds amazing, and I'd like to get started, but I need a little bit of support or maybe some training that you might suggest that could help folks take that first step or two?
Yes, absolutely. There are so many great organizations that are out there, and it be like from a university or a nonprofit, that I've said, I've got this going on at my school, and I'm either, you know, is there someone who's come and talk to my kids, or do you have any kind of grant programs? Would you be willing to do any in-kind donations? And I've never been turned down for anything like that, right? Because everyone wants to be involved in education. So I would tell teachers, like, educate yourself. Tree People is a great organization. Most Southern California folks know them, if not, you know, the entire state and beyond. Generation Earth will learn to get their students involved. They're very, very generous with their time, with their resources, with funding, with competition opportunities for kids to showcase what they learn, and just with resources. Like, you can get someone working within Generation Earth to really walk you through projects. We'll come in and do projects for you. And so I've always been involved with them because they've just been a super resource. I would also say California's EEI program, the Environmental Education Initiative program, those resources, if you are not a teacher that has time to kind of rewrite or look through your lessons, those are lessons that are super engaging and gives you a lot of variety and flexibility in how you can use them. And just the California Environmental Initiative program itself, they've been working statewide to try to get informal and formal educators together, right? So they've been a really good support system. And then there are a lot of local programs that I've worked with, the Bay Foundation. I've worked with Growing Great, which is in environmental, like garden science kind of programming that, like, that will come in and create and teach for you. So I would say, look at where you're interested. I mean, I'm an environmental educator, so my main goal is environmental literacy, and there's everything that comes underneath that. But if you're really looking for garden science, Occidental College has a really good program that has a website that's super helpful. Edible Schoolyard, they're another one where you can go on and get free resources. I really love California Science Academy. They're really good for, like, tying in environmental issues and things around the ocean that can be tied into your campus. And so I'm kind of a rabbit hole junkie when it comes to, like, environmental curriculum and programs. I glean stuff from across the pond. I glean stuff. Australia is a great country. I love getting curriculum and stuff from Australia. They have a lot of progressive work, and even like the Netherlands and stuff, they've got really good work around, like, when I'm looking up climate change kind of stuff, you know, looking at areas and the curriculum they have in other countries has been really eye-opening.
Well, teachers are always very resourceful, and it sounds like you're one of those as well. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for sharing with us a little bit about what you do and what you're a part of. We'll share some of those resources in our notes for some of those ideas of other organizations that can help. But I really appreciate the work you're doing, the vision that you and your colleagues are helping to foster, and for sharing with us some ideas about how to get started.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. You can tell I love to talk about it.
and when things open up, I want to come visit. I'm not too far away. I'm here in the San Fernando Valley. And so I want to see this for myself. I would love to.
Come. It's magical. Every time I get to go on campus, I'm like, that's heaven. I just love it. All of our sites are just beautiful that way. So yes, please do. We love to give tours.
And so I'm going to come too. When I saw the photos, she shared photos in the talk she gave, and it didn't look like a big campus, but it looked like a very well thought over campus. So anyhow, thank you again so much for giving us some of your time today. And I might follow up with you again for some other ideas. We eventually will like to help schools that we're working with move in this direction. And as a science publisher, we actually have the opportunity to talk to the leadership in districts. And they want to have a good active science program. And so they might listen to us when we make suggestions about training or even about potentially infrastructure in their campus. So we'll pick your brain, and Matt and I work together on some of this. We'll pick your brain some more on this in the future.
Sounds good. Check out Green Schools National Network too. If you are not aware of them, you're probably aware of them.
That's where we found you.
Oh, that's right. Cause that's the thing we were on. That's right. Keep up with them. They'll have, like, I think we're doing something coming up soon again. I think curriculum building around environmental literacy. At least I think we are. So yeah, let me know.
Okay. Thank you again.
Thank you. This was fun. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
Talk to you soon, Shonda. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now we turn our attention to climate change and the environment, where we review some of the latest news in this area and talk about how to bring such topics into our schools and classrooms. Matt, obviously we have a new government, and one of the priorities is climate change. What have you seen so far in terms of government action in response to climate change?
Well, I know that it's pretty exciting to see sort of the movement to get back on track, I think, is really the biggest thing that we've seen in our first couple of months here is just getting back on track with putting climate change back in the forefront. So there's these executive orders sort of stopping some of the dismantling process of regulations. There's executive orders about pipelines and oil leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and just trying to sort of put a pause on the damage that was being done and try and start us moving forward and getting back into the Paris Climate Accord. It's got the framework for things, and now comes the real work of actually doing it. And I know that the huge COVID relief bill was passed with a one point whatever something trillion. Mm-hmm. And that was all important aspects of economic justice. It didn't really find opportunities for putting environmental justice into that. And it was a missed opportunity perhaps, but with so much at stake, it kind of just get things out the door that are going to do good. And so I understand that, but I feel like that's sort of our possibilities for more jobs and Green New Deal, the whole, that New Deal word came as an effort to try and really jumpstart an economy. And there is such opportunity for that still that I haven't seen a huge amount of action yet on, mm-hmm. but that's simply because there's a lot going on in the world.
there's a lot going on. We have a pandemic to try to figure out. One executive order I noticed was Tackling the Climate Crisis at Home and Abroad. That was the title. And it had the formation of a number of goals and policies and the formation of an interagency working group, including Department of Treasury, Transportation, Interior, Agriculture, Energy, but missing was education. And I'm, and obviously you and I care about education. So how do we get policymakers to start considering education amongst the ideas and organizations that are going to tackle climate change?
Well, I can understand, the federal level, the federal sort of influence on education is different than the state level. So I think that the answer is to start at the appropriate level of government that really can have an influence on that. And we have that in California, where we have quite a bit of pressure being put on for our state, but other states certainly need a little bit of work there, and really making education have climate in it, have environmental education, all those things, really showing that potential to come forward is has to happen at, like I said, at the appropriate level of government, the state level of government, really. And I'm not surprised that the federal level of federal Department of Education has a more limited role.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I've just been, and we might have talked about this in the show before, that New Jersey took some state level action to integrate climate change into all content areas. And starting in the fall, this coming fall, it'll be in science and math and history. And then a year later, it'll be in the other content areas. And that happened at the state level because of the governor's support. And yet I still see an opportunity at the national level to at least mention it. And I feel like that we, either in academia or other areas, have not done a good job communicating the role that education can play, just like Shoshana just talked about, that type of educational experience, the benefit it can have to the local environment and to your ultimately to your national environment.
And I think I guess to get back to your questions, what's our lever? What is the appropriate lever? And I think actually my guess is it actually comes from business. You know, you've seen all the big players in technology who are so powerful now with the Apples and the Googles, really having a big pushes towards towards sustainability and as part of things, and really having them say, you know what, we need, you know, you want us to be leaders in becoming 100% renewable. You know, you want us to lead the way. That's what you sort of are, seems to be the way the world is working right now. You're asking us to do that. We need people that can think that way. And we want this as part of the educational system. And I think that as you start seeing industry demanding it, that I think is the best lever for us to get this involved, is people will listen to that and say, hey, that's right. That's what education is for, is to help prepare our workforce that is going to be the future creators, the future thinkers, the future solvers, the future builders. And if they're asking for this is one of those key skills, I think that's going to be heard and acted upon more than if, you know, educators, we raise our thing, your educators raise all the time about all sorts of things, but that's firm investment and they have a good standing to do it because, you know, it is so important. So many businesses are leading the way.
Mm. Do you see opportunities for teachers if you're suggesting, oh, maybe the state is a good place, a good lever where there's some possibility? And for the teachers who are listening right now, do you see opportunities for teachers to get involved in helping shape that kind of discussion and policy within the state level?
Well, I mean, definitely. You can see how the reason why California is doing this is because there were so many people that were pushing for this, some of them teachers, some of them former teachers that have moved out of the classroom and into sort of this policy realm of things. But it's not an accident. This is something that people have been pushing for so much. And you know, we were hearing a few minutes ago about the EEI curriculum, and the folks that developed that were influential in making sure that our California framework for science really fully integrated the environmental principles and concepts that they helped get into state law because they were pushing for that. So there's definitely a voice having specific suggestions like, hey, this is something that we want to put on our, integrate into our curriculum standards is a really good way to get started in that. And you said New Jersey, and we have this example from California, but those are definitely it. And maybe a smaller level, maybe you're not ready to be the teacher or lobbyist yet, but if I said that the lever is through business, then you start reaching out to some of those businesses and start getting guest speakers to come about sustainability to speak, so that you can start building that connection, getting that, plant the seeds in their head. Mm-hmm. They come as trying to tell you all about sustainability and business, and you then say, hey, education is so important for this, for you to carry this forward. You need to start asking for it. You need to start pushing for this to be included in education if you want it in your business.
Great point. Well, there we mentioned two states, but there's 48 others. So there's lots of opportunities. So now let's shift to our final segment where we talk burritos and everything related to burritos. Matt, I feel like it's been way too long since we chatted about this subject. So let's get going. Can I tell you that this week I ate 3 breakfast burritos in a row? It wasn't intentional. It just happened. Hmm. Is that a good thing?
A value judgment. I'm not sure how to approach this as a scientist here. You have to, as Dr. Burrito, you can tell me about the footprint of each of those burritos, and were they low footprint burritos, or were they was there something better you could have eaten that would have been more helpful to the world?
Well, that's a great question because those burritos, so this is my favorite local taqueria, and I do order the potato and egg and rice and bean burrito. And I could imagine that if I just had my normal breakfast, which is oats and maybe some nuts, that probably has a lower carbon footprint. But we also want to live a good life too. We don't want to just eat the same thing all the time. And in these cases, I had the opportunity to share one of those meals with my dad, or one of those meals with someone else in a kind of safe setting. So then there was that, like you said, there's this other value, this social value of eating. But I imagine that if we offered that question to students, that simple question, we could start to think about it from various perspectives. What ideas might you have if we were to try to determine whether a diet like that, and maybe you would just do this once, but what if you did this every week? Or what if you like that McDonald's, what was that Fast Food Nation film where the guy just ate McDonald's every day? How could we bring this question into the science classroom?
Yeah, well, is thinking about what are we trying to optimize? What are we trying to, this is an engineering problem, really. And, you know, engineering problems involve knowing all of your criteria and your constraints. And so you've got constraints about the amount of money you've got, constraints about the amount of time you have. And so those are there. And then what criteria we want to be minimal impact to the environment, and basically walking our students through this process of what are all the things they're balancing, the social aspects of eating, the just emotional aspect of eating the same thing every day. And these are all parts of what makes engineering more interesting than science, is that these human aspects of preferences really do make a difference. And we need to have some way to do that. And actually, if you look at our California Framework Instructional Strategies chapter, it gives you some tips on how you can start making that a little bit more systematic. Yes, there are preferences. And yes, preferences are crucial in engineering solutions, figuring out which engineering solutions are best. But how can you do that in a way that's systematic, so that you can be very thoughtful about it, and not just sort of impulsive and letting your short-term impulses determine what is going to be the optimal solution.
And which chapter in the framework is that, Matt?
I don't remember my chapter numbers.
Oh, my gosh. It has been a few years, hasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Anyhow, we'll put a link in the notes there to some of that guidance. Well, I think that's a good place to stop. Thanks for joining us today at Ask Matt, where we explore NGSS, science education, and the environment with education expert and nice guy, Matt Delasio. Thanks, Matt, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, absolutely. So much fun to be here again.